The story of black holes is a fascinating one, and it got recently a new twist. And for those of you who followed the archive, you probably in the last half year, you noticed all kinds of papers where people have been debating whether or not if you fall into a black hole, if you actually get burned or bump your head or actually really fall into the black hole. And indeed, that has been now a lively debate with workshops in the past and the future. We're actually learning something new here. To some extent, that seems like a big step backwards. Obviously, I'm not going to tell you the whole story of the black hole physics confusions that we've had, but the main result, of course, that created this confusion was that of Hawking, that if you have a black hole, that it is actually a quantum mechanical object, and the real challenge that people have to try to come to grips with is precisely this tension between, on the one hand, this absolute hole that you can throw something in and lose it forever. On the other hand, the fact that it's a quantum mechanical object that maintains some memory of its history and actually returns information eventually, that tension is the thing that is really still driving the debate. And of course, that was the information paradox. The fact that, on the one hand, you can throw your Library of Congress into a black hole and you should never see it back. On the other hand, the fact that it radiates tells you that, in principle, you should be able to decipher the quantum information that went into a black hole by being very clever about decoding this radiation. Hawking, at the time, said, well, this is not possible. Just look at the space-time diagram of a black hole. A black hole is huge. There are now black holes that have 10 billion solar masses. That's 4 light days across. And we tend to think about that black hole. Indeed, if you would fall into it at this moment, probably it would not still be like being in this room. But nonetheless, if the black hole singularity is 4 light days away, then the black hole horizon, at least the way we think about it, should be a smooth region of space. But at the same time, we know that there should be such a thing as a quantum mechanical description of black holes. And Polchinski, Sully, what was the first? Okay. I forgot his name. Almeri, Polchinski, Sully, and Marov came up with a clever argument where they were taking seriously rules of quantum information theory and essentially put the puzzle out there that a black hole could not remain in existence as a smooth region of space. And let me just give you their argument in a nutshell. So here it is. You don't need to read what the letters here. I'll talk about this as I go along. So you look at this picture, and this is the picture roughly that you could read in a book by Hawking about what Hawking radiation is. So the idea is that you have a black hole from which nothing can escape, but quantum mechanically somehow this thing can radiate. And the picture that comes with pitfalls, which we'll see in a second, that Hawking presents there is the fact that in quantum mechanics there are quantum fluctuations in the vacuum, and you can have particles that get pair created. So you have a particle and its antiparticle that at any point in space are being produced and annihilate again. But the fact that there's a horizon from which nothing can escape changes that story because one of the pairs, one of the half of a pair goes inside of the black hole and the other half of the pair escapes. So that's the picture of Hawking radiation. And Hawking derived this fact that black holes radiate from one basic assumption, namely that the horizon of a black hole is smooth. It looks like empty space down here. And from that, he derived that things had to pancreate down there, and that one half of the pairs is producing the Hawking radiation. So this is called the Hawking pair. This is the Hawking partner of those particles. But now you can, I've illustrated here arrows in a way that illustrates the entanglement. Basically, the state of this particle is correlated with the state of that particle. These are quantum mechanical particles. So the mere existence of this particle must be correlated and entangled with the existence of that particle. And this could be your point of view of how Hawking radiation comes about. And in recent times, people have been creating things that they call bit models, where precisely they want to keep track of the flow of information in accordance with these pictures. But now, already, immediately, you get into a problem. Because if you now imagine asking what happens to these two particles that went in, they have to escape from the black hole as well. But A is entangled with E, B is entangled with R. E stands for early, R stands for radiation. But now suppose that A and B later on want to also escape from the black hole, because eventually the black hole will spit out all its content. So what happens if A wants to, or B wants to leave the black hole? Then it wants to be in a situation that sort of looks like this, because this was the situation that you need in order to have a smooth horizon. But since R already left the black hole and was far away by the time that B wants to escape, B can escape from the black hole only by itself. It can try to be entangled in the same way with something else. Say it wants to be entangled with A, but B and A are not entangled, because A is entangled with E, B is entangled with R, B and A are not entangled. And by the time that B wants to leave the horizon, it's doing it in a situation that does not correspond to a smooth horizon. And that's where the firewall gets formed. So that's, in a nutshell, the argument of AMPS, the nowadays called, the Santa Barbara group, that because of the fact that a black hole can radiate, eventually it would have to radiate stuff in a way that does not coincide with the criterion of a smooth horizon. Let me give another way of stating this a little bit. Is if you have this picture of a black hole sending off radiation, you can think about this as two systems, as the black hole and as the radiation. And the state is such that these things have to be entangled with each other, because the radiation is produced via this process. And as time goes on, the radiation contains more and more of the mass of the black hole. It also contains more and more of the information of the black hole. And eventually, so let's first look at the early part of it. So suppose that the black hole starts out as a quantum mechanical object, perhaps in a pure state, although I don't believe that black holes can really exist in a pure state. But suppose it has sort of relatively little entropy. Then in the radiation process, it actually increases its entropy, because the entropy of this system is obtained by tracing over this system. And if there's entanglement, this entropy will go up in time. So if we draw a plot, which is usually called the Page curve, that if this is time, and this is the entropy of the black hole, then if the black hole, say, starts at time t equals 0, with maybe an entropy that's not maximal, but as time goes on, the entropy has to increase because it sends out more and more radiation. However, the mass of the black hole decreases, and there's this famous Bekenstein-Hawking formula that the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of a black hole is bounded by 4 pi m squared, this, which follows from essentially Hawking's calculation. That tells you if, because the mass of the black hole decreases with time, if you plot this quantity as a function of time, that goes down like that. And eventually what has to happen is that the black hole entropy as a function of time can initially increase, but eventually it has to start decreasing. So it has to come like this. So this is known as the page curve. That tells you as a function of time, the entropy can increase for a while, but eventually it has to decrease. And it's really, the question is, how is it possible for a black hole to be radiating stuff and losing its mass in a way that produces entanglement, but nonetheless, it has to decrease its entropy? How is that possible? Typically, if you are entangled with something else, you increase your entropy. And that's basically another way of stating the firewall paradox. So it should say, though, that this question is relatively pushing things to a certain limit. Because, again, we know for a solar mass black hole that this whole evaporation process takes about 10 to the 77 years. So you have to here imagine not measuring this thing for like 10 to the 77 years. And therefore, there's a kind of an idealization going on. And so one should be aware of all of this, is that we're imagining that we're describing this thing quantum mechanically. But in any case, so this was the puzzle. And then at least what happened was that there were papers rather quickly after the Santa Barbara papers, people immediately saying, well, it's absurd if a black hole has a singular horizon. It should not be true. These people have made a mistake here. And then there was lots of emails back and forth. And then typically, actually, the people, the Santa Barbara people with this came with this argument, actually won most of those exchanges. So there were a bunch of months where people essentially believed this argument that there had to be a firewall eventually. But there's something definitely wrong with the argument, because basically what's being done here, yes. A rock and a hard place.
Yeah, between
a firewall and a something else. So and indeed, it says here that what you would have to do is you have to reestablish, if you believe that things have to be smooth in the end, then you would have to essentially relate that quantum A to quantum R. Because basically, that thing can only be smooth if A can turn into R. And I should say, indeed, obviously, it has always been a puzzle.
I guess it's because of the original calculation that if A and B were not entangled right across the horizon, then the local energy density would blow up.
Right. So the smoothness of the horizon leads to disentanglement, and disentanglement prevents entanglement up there. That's the basic argument. Yeah. But then people already realized this a long time ago, and indeed, this was basically the information paradox. How is it possible that the radiation that comes out here eventually actually knows about stuff that sits here? And the idea of black hole complementarity is that you actually, you can have a smooth horizon. You can have Hawking radiation, but you should not try to describe both of them in the same semi-classical reality. So if you look at a black hole, you stay either outside, and if you stay outside, you see the Hawking radiation. But then the horizon is really your horizon. You cannot see farther than it. And in some ways, it's actually a singular part of space-time, because every probe that an asymptotic observer has of the horizon is a singular probe. Why is that? Because any finite frequency mode that I see coming from the horizon actually was an extremely blue-shifted mode close to the horizon. So a probe of the horizon of the outside observer is singular. And this is what led to the idea of black hole complementarity, because basically the horizon cannot be viewed as a classical region of space-time when you're outside. And then you can introduce something that's called the stretched horizon, Or nowadays, you would maybe justify that on the basis of ADS-CFT, or the way in which in string theory we built black holes, or in any other theory of gravity, where we tend to now think about a black hole as a real physical object, but roughly with the size of the black hole horizon. If you're sitting outside, there it seems like there are physical degrees of freedom that are sitting at the horizon, and that could be your outside description. And that's indeed going to be the point of view that I'm going to take. I'm going to explain, again, the origin of this paradox, and I'll try to resolve it at the end, but based on the rules of quantum mechanics. I'm not going to be drawing too many space-time diagrams, because people just tend to get confused over those. I just want to have rules of quantum mechanics. And those are the ones that I'm going to apply. And essentially, what I'm going to do is I'm going to think about the black hole, indeed, as this object that has the size of the horizon, has quantum mechanical states. Think about it as a big hydrogen atom. It just happens to have many states. Hydrogen atom has a bunch of energy levels. Black holes have energy levels. And I'm going to describe this radiation process the way you would describe it in unitary quantum mechanics by means of a Hamiltonian. I'm not going to know what the Hamiltonian is, but I know thermodynamically how it will behave in the same way as, for example, Einstein, with his studies of A and B coefficients, was able to determine properties of atoms based on thermodynamics, the fact that atoms can radiate. I'm going to be thinking about black holes as quantum mechanical objects that radiate. So that's the outside perspective. But then, in order to resolve the what we call the information paradox, you would also have to come up with a story for the inside perspective. The question is, how is it possible that a quantum mechanical object that seems to just have its all kinds of degrees of freedom at the horizon, how is it possible that that object can actually look smooth on the interior if you fall into it? What happens if you throw yourself into a black hole? Why is the horizon smooth? That question, I should already warn you here, at least for those of you who know about ADS-CFT, is of course sort of similar to what ADS-CFT is doing. And ADS-CFT was always viewed as kind of a realization of what's called the holographic principle, that if you have a system that's sufficiently rich that you put on a lower dimensional space, that that it's actually possible for that system to create what we call an emergent dimension, that whatever happens down here can be formulated in terms of degrees of freedom that sits down there. So that's the idea of black hole complementarity, is that there are these two perspectives, the outside, for which you have this membrane, or the inside, where you really think about this as classical space-time. Now, the problem with the AMPS argument, yes? So whether you can think about a black hole as a static system?
Yeah,
that's yeah, I'll answer that question. Basically, the answer is the same way as for I would answer it for a hydrogen, for an any atom. Namely, for an atom, we know what to do. We first solve the free, we go to the interaction picture. Yeah. We write the Hilbert space in terms of the free Hamiltonian, where we have excited states, and then we have an interaction Hamiltonian that tells you how the system interacts with its environment. And if you would turn off the interaction between a black hole and its environment, then a black hole can be eternal. And that's the same as sort of turning off the interaction between an atom and the radiation field. Then the atoms can also be stable. So this is typically what you do if you have resonances, if you have bound states or whatever, which are not really asymptotic states, but you add them to the Hilbert space in an interaction picture. But I should say that this whole idea of black hole complementarity, that there are two ways of describing the same quantum mechanical reality, but giving two different classical realities associated with it, that's precisely the thing that the firewall argument is trying to undermine. Because they say, whatever you do, you will not be able to recreate this internal space-time because of the fact that there's no entanglement anymore. And this line here becomes singular by the time that you would be talking about an old black hole. So this is the terminology that people use, although people disagree about some of it. But roughly, this is called the pre-page time. This is called the page time, this turnaround point. This is pre-page, which I'll call young, but it's all relative. And this is an old black hole. And the problem of the firewall paradox has to do with old black holes. Personally, this is already illustrating the weakness in the argument. I personally don't believe that the age of a black hole will really matter much for its physical properties. But the problem here, and I should mention this, that's important, here the entropy starts saturating the Beckenson-Hawking bound in this region. And so we're talking about a state of a black hole that we call maximally mixed. So the black hole has a density matrix that starts saturating the Beckenson-Hawking bound, and that's where the problem appears. So let me illustrate that in this picture. So I'm not sure if you can read this. Unfortunately, this doesn't come out quite as well as I hope. So there's a state which is in the Hilbert space of a black hole. Let me take this pointer so I can read it for you in case it's hard to read directly. So there's a state I that specifies the black hole. Think about this as the excitation state of a hydrogen atom, but it happens to be that it's a hydrogen atom. It has a very dense energy spectrum, and the spacing between the energy levels is counted by the level density, which essentially grows like the entropy of a black hole, which is given by this Bekenstein-Hawking formula, 4 pi m squared. So that's what the black hole is. It has a very big Hilbert space, e to the power s e to the power 4 m squared, with very dense energy levels. And I just take a state in that. However, a black hole is not a pure state, and we want to describe it as a mixed state because it can evolve in time and be entangled with something else. So I'm going to draw you have to think about this as a matrix. This is I, that's j, and this is the density matrix of the black hole. And it will have a form like this. It's a sum over all possible states that it might have occupied with certain probability p. And the reason for why it's a mixed state is because actually the full state of the full system is an entangled state between the black hole and the environment. The environment state here is denoted by phi. And if I take this and I trace over the environment, I get this this density matrix. Yes?
Clarification. So some of these questions impinge on foundational questions about quantum mechanics. In particular, are you taking the point of view that the whole universe is described always by a pure state, and if the black hole is in a mixed state, it's only because of being entangled with something else?
I don't want to go there necessarily. For now, I'll be mostly talking about the mixed state situation. So how does mixed state appear, whether it was tracing over something that was in our universe or in some other universe, I don't care. So if I deal with mixed states, that's precisely the whole purpose of dealing with mixed states, that you start forgetting about what sits here. It is still useful to know that if you start out with a mixed state, there's a thing that we call the purification. I can take this thing and write it in such a form. And one important thing, which actually already, if you think about it, eliminates the scenario that the Santa Barbara group, the firewall scenario. One thing that should be true is that the properties of a mixed state, if I'm just probing the Hilbert, apply operators to this thing and look at what the properties of this thing are, cannot depend on what we call on the purification. So whatever the purification is, the properties of this thing should not depend on it. If you think about the firewall argument, they actually they bypass that particular truth. I'm introducing here another concept which will be important in the following, and it should be clear why I'm doing this. If this is the full Hilbert space of the black hole, then the entropy represented by this full line is that maximal entropy. And the way you have to think about this process is that the density matrix of the black hole is spreading out itself over the full Hilbert space. I could diagonalize the density matrix if I want, but the number of terms that I write down here eventually will equate with n, which is the dimension of the Hilbert space. But this thing will start growing with time. And the problem, the firewall problem, will start appearing when this sum really fills up the whole diagonal, when I really sum over the full size of the Hilbert space. But I will introduce a control parameter for the problem that we're going to meet, which I call the code space, which is a subspace of the full Hilbert space. And I'm assuming that the black hole Hilbert space for now, that the black hole state fits inside of that code space, meaning that the probabilities are only non-zero for states inside of the code space. Eventually, I can take the limit where the code space equals the full space, and we'll see actually a problem indeed appearing, which is the firewall problem. But we'll understand it better when that happens. So this is just giving me the initial state of the black hole. Are there any questions about this? So now I want to look at this black hole in its environment. And the way I'll do that is as follows. Indeed, I'll take exactly the point of view that you would take for an hydrogen atom that radiates. So I'll describe the black hole, the interior of the black hole, by a state that I'll call I. I have the environment of the black hole, which could be either the radiation that it sent out a long time ago, it could be other universes, it could be all kinds of other stuff that I'll lump into this quantity. But since I want to investigate the black hole radiation process, and in particular, I want to be able to investigate the region close to the black hole horizon, what I'll do is I want to be able to have a Hilbert space that represents what we call the radiation field, right? If you look at a hydrogen atom, you have the radiation field and you have the hydrogen atom. And the Hamiltonian of the combined system contains a Hamiltonian of the atom, which in this case is the Hamiltonian of the black hole. It contains the Hamiltonian of the radiation field. And these are both free Hamiltonians. And if I turn off the interaction, then this system can be in an eigenstate, energy eigenstate. But now the interaction is the thing that creates the radiation. Okay? It contains the coupling to the radiation field to whatever operator is emitting it. In the case of a hydrogen atom, it's the dipole operator that emits the radiation. In the case of a black hole, I don't know what operator that is. But there's some operator that creates the radiation. And I'm going to give myself that operator. And for those of you, again, who know ADS-CFT, it's the same as the ADS-CFT dictionary. If I know the asymptotic value of a field, there's a dual operator in the bulk. And if I want to know how the field propagates into the bulk, I want to know which operator couples to that field. And so this interaction Hamiltonian will create modes in the radiation zone. This is the radiation zone down here. And it will create it with an operator that I'll introduce in a second. One other important thing about this, actually, which slightly looks worrisome if you think about it, I take the black hole Hilbert space, I take the environment, but initially I put the radiation field in its ground state, meaning there are no Hawking particles at time t equals 0 in this zone. Now, that may look worrisome because basically, if for those of you who know about all of this stuff, there's this thing called the Boulware vacuum. And basically, I'm putting this thing in the Boulware vacuum, which no one in his right mind would do if you're a relativist, because the Boulware vacuum is singular at the horizon. But this is my initial state, and I'm going to have an interaction Hamiltonian, which will quickly start filling up this thing. And actually, this also makes clear that what I'm putting in here is the rules of quantum mechanics. I'm not going to be putting in the fact that the horizon is smooth. I'm putting in just rules of quantum mechanics. I'm drawing this picture for you, but right now this is all I have, an internal state, a radiation state in the vacuum, and these are the two things that I'm going to be looking at. I'm tracing over this piece.
Sorry, I'm confused about you. You split up the Hamiltonian in three parts, that's clear. But
how about the Hilbert space?
The Hilbert space, I don't understand. One is for the black hole, one is for the radiation.
Yeah, so because people in this business like Alice and Bob, they call the black hole Alice, or at least someone inside of the black hole is going to be Alice. Alice is going to throw herself inside of the black hole. So I'm going to black hole Hilbert space. I'm now calling it HA. Sometimes it's easier to say A and B than. Okay. And B is the name for the late radiation. So the late radiation is coming out here. So I have a region A, which is the black hole. I have a region B, which is delayed radiation. And the key question that I want to ask is, if someone would fall into the black hole down here, is the state of this combined system entangled or not in a way that would allow me to claim that the horizon is smooth?
So you split the radiation Hilbert space into two pieces.
That's right.
Early and late.
Right, and I'm only looking at late. And one other terminology you could say, well, this is the Hawking atmosphere. And this is all the stuff that you don't want to worry about if you ask about local questions near the horizon. So this is the Hawking atmosphere, okay? It's also, you can call it the reservoir in which the black hole is going to radiate. How am I doing with time? Okay, so my initial state is a mixed state. It's the state that I talked about, which is just some density matrix of the black hole state. And I put the radiation in the vacuum. That's my initial state. And now I'm doing nothing else than just quantum mechanics. I'm just telling you that there is a time later where this thing will have evolved in terms of the unitary operator, like so. And this unitary operator contains the interaction Hamiltonian. So although the initial state was sort of factorized into a vacuum state of the radiation times the internal state of the black hole, soon after, this thing will be mixed. N here denotes any radiation state in the radiation Hilbert space. So N is some Fock space state. It could even be QCD, if you like. It could be some energy state of a quantum field theory in the environment. And the black hole plus the environment plus this radiation zone B combined will be in some mixed state that looks like that. Okay? And I'm going to tell you more about these rho and m's in a second. But this is just a general form. So these rho and m's are density matrices, partial density matrices, defined on the Hilbert space of the black hole. And here I'm explicitly writing down the density matrix part on the radiation piece. And this illustrates that indeed, because of the radiation, because of the interaction Hamiltonian, that these things don't stay in their vacuum state. And indeed, if you now trace over the internal part of the black hole, you trace over A, then the radiation should be in some thermal state, which follows just from thermodynamics. Because I know the dimension of the Hilbert space, thermodynamics tells me that this should be the state of the radiation. Or you could say, well, Hawking told us that this should be the state of the radiation, okay? Where this Wn is just the Boltzmann factor, e to the minus beta times the entropy, and I'm normalizing it with z such that the trace of this thing is equal to 1. Note, by the way, that the entropy of B is some positive number. It's log z plus beta times e, the expectation value of the energy. And for a young black hole, this indeed means that since it's emitting a state with entropy, that also the entropy of the black hole will increase by a corresponding amount. That's typically what you would expect. Now comes actually a little bit of math, because we're actually really going to do calculations. I'm no longer going to talk about space-time diagrams. We're actually compute. And it turns out you can compute way more than you think you might.
Separating the radiation field in the near zone from the black hole itself.
That's right.
Won't it very, very rapidly evolve to be a maximal entropy state?
Will it very rapidly evolve?
Very rapidly, yeah, much more rapidly than space time or anything like that.
We can talk, we should talk about this. Right. I think it's very interesting. I agree with you. To some extent, it should be where I would like to this thing to do like that. I think I agree with you. But by the way, I'm going to compute the Page curve for you in the model that I'm about to give. I'll compute this thing with all square roots and logarithms, et cetera. I'll compute this curve exactly for you. This was actually at the workshop in Santa Barbara where people were fighting about this firewalls. One of the conclusions of this workshop was Andy Stroman just says, OK, anyone who has a model who claims to understand what's going on should be able to compute this curve. I'm going to show you the formula for that curve on the next slide. But what are my computation rules? The computation rules are very simple. Here we go. I have already told you actually what they are. U is a unitary operator that acts on the internal state of the black hole and the vacuum state of the radiation. you can always decompose it this way. Cn is here an operator. It's an operator that acts on I. So I is the internal state of the black hole, and Cn is an operator that acts on the internal Hilbert space of the black hole. For those of you who know about, and I'm sure many in the audience know more than I do, about quantum computing systems, things like that, this is the way you would describe a quantum computer. This is the internal state of the quantum computer. This is the environment. And this is how a quantum computer loses uses coherence, because there's an Hamiltonian, an interaction Hamiltonian with the environment. And the thing will evolve into some kind of entangled state between the quantum computer and the environment. Now, there it is. These things then are called Krauss operators, Cn. And since this is a unitary operation, you have a unitary relationship for these operators, Cn. That's this one. Now, what else do I know? Basically, nothing. But nothing is more than you think it is, because basically, the Cn's, I'm going to assume, are completely random matrices, meaning are completely ergodic in the following sense, that if I take any state of the internal black hole, I, and any other state, J, then the corresponding matrix element of that operator Cn is some random chosen number. But it statistically will have a certain average value. So I'm just saying that this operator Cn will treat all the Hilbert space states of the black hole in a democratic, in an equal way. Not exactly, but on average it will. Okay. So what that means, for example, is that if I take two states, I and J, of the internal of the state of the black hole, and I multiply C times its complex conjugate, then I know to a very high accuracy what number I'm going to get. Because if I take this operator C and I multiply it times the complex conjugate of a thing that does not have the same label n, what this will amount to is a sum over many random phase factors that, and how many of them, e to the power s, so a gazillion of them. And those phase factors are uncorrelated. So it's a random walk in phase space, in all kinds of directions. And this thing will average out to an accuracy of 1 over square root of n, just by a random walk. Except where n and m are each other's, are equal. Then this thing is always the complex conjugate of that. And then I'm summing the phases in the same direction. And therefore, this thing will average out into something big. How big? I already know that I'm getting some number times delta and m. And actually, also, if k and I are different, then the same argument will tell me that phase factors would cancel out if they're different. If they are the same, then the phase factors will add up. And I know this number. This is just the Boltzmann factor, because of the fact that thermodynamics, just the counting of dimension of the Hilbert space. So I know that on average, that this is the outcome. And I can actually estimate what the corrections to this are. It's 1 over square root of n are the corrections to this formula. Okay, so I have this piece of information. I'm putting here an average, which is think of as a phase average. But these C's are actual matrices, and the microscopic theory knows what they are. So I'm not treating them as a matrix ensemble. But nonetheless, this is kind of, you think about this as an expectation value in a matrix ensemble. And then you can think about this as a Wick contraction, if you wish. But this is how I can compute thermodynamically. There's another Wick contraction, which is this one, with C dagger. This is the Wick contraction that you would get if you would want to compute the density matrix of the thermal radiation. So this actually produces the thermal radiation. And actually, in the whole quantum computing, people make the same kind of assumption about the operators that create quantum decoherence. And it's this particular equation, actually, that allows for a procedure that's called quantum error correction, where you kind of undo this operation. And we're going to be making use of that in a second. There's another statistical sum you can do. It as this one. And for the same statistical reasonings, it leads to this formula. So these are called Wick contractions. And in our paper, we have a name for these. These are called the good contractions, and these are called the bad contractions. And it turns out that the good contractions are the ones that allow you to reconstruct the interior of the black hole. Exactly. It will allow you to show that the interior of the black hole is smooth. The bad contractions are fluctuations, are breakdowns of quantum field theory in the interior, turns out. And we'll see that in a second. Are there any questions about this? This is the only place where we make a physical input. From now on, you can just compute. Okay. So I'm going to flash the formula for the page curve in a second. I'll tell you how it was computed. I will not show the computation, but it's straightforward. It just follows from these formulas. The way it's computed is the way you should compute it. You take this thing here. You trace over this. So you take the corresponding density matrix. You trace over this part. And then you get the density matrix for A, which is the density matrix of the black hole. And then you use these rules to compute what that density matrix is.
No question.
Yes?
Your time, is it killing time? Like, or is it the time of a stretched horizon? Or is it more like the proper time of a local time?
Good question. Let me go back. It is the time that you would get if you would turn off the interaction Hamiltonian. So you would have an eternal black hole sitting here. So it's the Schwarzschild time. So everything is done in terms of the Schwarzschild time. OK, so let me say one thing. So in the next slide, there's going to be a formula that will show the density matrix at a certain energy level. So these n's are states of the radiation. And I can have a bunch of states at a given energy. I call that D of E. And I can look at the density matrix of the black hole after it has emitted an amount of energy E. And I can compute the entropy of that density matrix by doing trace rho log rho, the way you would normally compute the von Neumann entropy. And this is the formula. Okay, so what do you do is the following. Is you take this, you compute this density matrix, which is quadratic in the C's. There's a C and a C dagger in it, because the psi is proportional to C, and rho is proportional to C, C dagger. Then you square your density matrix, and you can do a Wick contraction. And if you do a Wick contraction, you can express the square of the density matrix in terms of the density matrix itself plus an identity. Now, there are two Wick contractions. One of them is the good Wick contraction, which is this one. And that's the bad Wick contraction. And this is just some normal ordering business. But here I have a quadratic equation for a matrix. And I can compute its eigenvalue of the matrix. I can compute trace rho log rho just based on this equation. And here's the curve, where y is the ratio of the maximal size of the Hilbert space, which is the e to the power of the entropy of the Hilbert space. And C is the actual entropy of your density matrix. So if the black hole is not fully mixed, if the black hole is fully mixed, if you're really all the way squished against this curve here, then this ratio here is 1. However, if you're all the way down here, then this ratio could be exponentially small. Exponentially big. N is much bigger than NC. So Y is very big early on, but it's very small later on. DB is, again, is this number of states, energy E. Anyway, here's the curve, and you can compute it just by doing the usual eigenvalue diagonalization of that thing. And indeed, you can look at two limiting cases. So if NC is much smaller than N, you can take the limit in this formula, and what you'll see is that the initial state of the black hole had entropy log nc. Nc is the entropy of the black log nc is the entropy of the black hole, what you start out with. And indeed, if you look at the state a little bit later, where it evolved into a state plus its radiation, the entropy of the black hole plus its radiation is the same as the entropy of the initial black hole that evolved in that state, because there was a unitary evolution. But now I'm tracing over the radiation, and I get a contribution that's only the state of the black hole. And not surprisingly, indeed, you find that it's log nc plus the entropy of the radiation that's just sitting there. So indeed, the black hole increases its entropy by the amount of radiation it emits. But if I take the same formula and I look at very late times, where this thing is equal to 1, I get a different behavior. I get, indeed, that the initial black hole had entropy log n, but after it has emitted radiation, it goes to log n minus beta e, which is what you would expect. Because the black hole decreases its energy, its entropy should go down, and you're squished against this formula. So this curve here is this formula. OK. Now there's another thing that one can do. So I'm going to now show you that you can.
Did you compute nc there as a function of time or not? Or?
Yes, to some extent one does. Because basically, if you start out with nc, so there's this whole notion. So there's this Hilbert space of the radiation, OK? And I didn't tell you too much about it. It depends actually on the structure of the near horizon geometry if you really want to be precise about it. But if I give you a certain amount of time that this thing can evolve, if there's a certain time interval that it can radiate, then the way one does these computations is to say, oh, that means that my energy E is quantized in units of 1 over that amount of time that it's allowed to radiate. So you look at a time interval, and then your energy spacing here is proportional to that 1 over time. So this E increases with time. Or you can do this iteratively. So every time you start out with a state with an entropy log nc, then you let it radiate, and you have a new entropy at a later moment, you use that as your initial condition for the next step. So you can view this as a time step. OK?
We don't have an actual formula. For, you have some approximate formula for nc as a function of time.
You would have to do this iteratively, basically. Again, we can talk about this. But you have to do this iteratively. Another thing, by the way, that this formula would tell you, actually, this piece here with that behavior, if you do the Preskill-Hayden, for those of you who know about this, Gedanken experiment, where you take an EPR pair, or you take P EPR pairs, a bunch of EPR pairs, and you throw half of them into the black hole. And then you ask, how long does it take for the information that goes into the black hole to come back? And it turns out that this formula actually tells you how long that it takes for it to come back. And it indeed means that if you throw it into a young black hole in this definition, it will take a very long time for that information to come back. But as Preskill and Hayden already showed, if you have an old black hole, it actually will come back very quickly. And the process by which it's come back is precisely this process, actually, turns out. But anyway, so let me go to the Amps paradox. Now, basically, what we'd like to do here is we'd like to take this state. Let me write it down here. Which is just this one. So it's the sum over n of some operator cn acting on the internal Hilbert space times this thing. This is the radiation. This is of the black hole. If you wish, you can write this in slightly more explicitly. Sum over n cn ij j n. So this is the black hole A. A and B, BH are the same thing. So it's an entangled state where the internal state of the black hole is entangled with the radiation. And the entanglement is created through the fact that there's this microscopic operator, Cn. And the way you have to think about Cn, I called it the Krauss operator, but you have to think about it as whatever quantum mechanical operator is responsible for emitting radiation. And what you would do in ADS-CFT, you would do the following. If I know which mode is being emitted by which operator, I know how to take this mode and throw it into the bulk of ADS-CFT. And the way I would do that is precisely via the ADS-CFT dictionary. This is the creation operator that creates that mode. Or, yeah, so it creates the mode outside. But I want to create the mode inside. and how do I get the mode inside, I kind of want to turn back this operation. And this is precisely what happens in quantum error-correcting codes. So what people do in quantum error-correcting codes, they look at this process. They start out with a state that initially was the state of the quantum computer with its environment, and it evolved into this state. Now, this is a problem, because now the quantum computer is no longer in a pure state. So you want to undo this operation. Now, to undo a Hamiltonian evolution, it's easy. You go back in Hamiltonian evolution. But it's actually not so easy, because this Hamiltonian also acted on the radiation, and I'm only allowed to act on the state of the quantum computer itself. And I'm giving myself that rule that I can only act on the internal Hilbert space, because I want to construct the interior of the Hilbert space. I want to construct the operators on the inside of the Hilbert, on the inside of the black hole. So I'm going to undo this time evolution by means of an operator that only acts on the interior of the Hilbert space. In the quantum computing literature, that's called the recovery superoperator. And basically, and it's not surprising, it's essentially up to basically a projection on the code space. It's just C dagger. C dagger is just returning it back in time. But the C dagger has a label N, which depends on the state that it's emitted. And then people develop something that they call a recovery superoperator, where you give yourself an auxiliary Hilbert space. It's called the ancillary Hilbert space, that has the same structure as the outside Hilbert space, but it has a label, if you, I'm not sure you can read it, has a label A of the, for ancillary Hilbert space. And for, so you give yourself a basis of states labeled by these integers N in some other Hilbert space, and you sum all these operators C star in this combination. This is known as the recovery superoperator. Okay? And it has a remarkable property. It tells you that it does the following. If I take the unitary evolution forward in time, I apply the recovery operator, but I'm applying it not just to the internal state and the radiation Hilbert space, but I also have this auxiliary Hilbert space initially in the vacuum, like that. And I can take this combination, and essentially this R is going to act like the inverse of U. Indeed, the state I will go back to itself. And this is precisely what you want in a quantum computing business. You want to keep the purity of your quantum computer, and you want to keep the state the same. But one of the things that is an automatic mathematical consequence of the thermodynamic formulas that I wrote down before is that it produces the internal Hilbert space, but it creates some thermal stuff in the meantime. Because basically, you try to reverse, you work up against the second law of thermodynamics, and actually, you create some entropy. And it turns out that the entropy is precisely in the form of a state that we recognize, maybe I should have introduced this earlier, as the unruh state. It's precisely the state that produces the local vacuum here. This state here looks like sum over n, square root of wn, n inside times n outside. It turns out that this recovery operation indeed produces precisely a second state that looks exactly like that vacuum state. So the conclusion is the following, is that if I have a state that looks like this, I can always write it essentially as a state like that, and this is what we call the vacuum at the horizon. And indeed, if the state looks like this, then I would be able to tell you how a state propagates inwards. Let me do that quickly. Essentially, maybe I should be a bit quick here. Basically, if I want to construct an operator that lives on the inside of the black hole, what you do is you do the following, is you create an operator that initially acts on this Hilbert space, which I call the auxiliary Hilbert space. But the auxiliary Hilbert space is something that I'm just using as a tool. And I'm sandwiching this operator with the recovery operator. And I also take the inner product of the auxiliary Hilbert space. So this operator will only act on the interior of the Hilbert space of the black hole. But it turns out that this thing has exactly the properties of the quantum field theory algebra on the interior of the black hole. So quantum mechanics allows us to start out with something that doesn't know about smooth horizons. It's just, it knows about radiation. It knows about how things evolve in time. But you're able actually to just write down operators that have a smooth behavior as if it's propagating through a smooth time. The following slide may look technical, but for those of you who are into these kind of things, it may clarify something. Here I'm describing you the calculation of the density matrix, the expectation value of an operator that I just defined, with an operator in the environment of the black hole, so outside of the black hole. So this is outside of the black hole. This is inside of the black hole, but defined in the way I just did it. And I want to look at its expectation value in the density matrix that I defined. And the claim is that it will look like the expectation value in the Unruh vacuum. It will look like an expectation value in Minkowski space, where basically you can just propagate through the horizon. For those of you who know about the black hole final state proposal, you may recognize something slightly similar in here, but this is a variation of this. So what happens is you have the initial state of the black hole with the vacuum state outside. You evolve it forward in time. That's what this thing is doing. Now, I'm just going to borrow briefly a vacuum state, which I'm going to throw away later on. I apply basically the inverse of this operation, this is this recovery operation, on the Hilbert space only of the interior of the black hole. And then I've created a state that will look like the Unruh vacuum between B and A. And now I can act with operators here. And then I just go back. And that's how you evolve, compute this expectation value. And indeed, we'll have the properties of a black hole horizon. So if you, so in terms of the title of the talk, this essentially is how you fall into a black hole. You start out with a system that only has quantum mechanical rules, and you're able to reconstruct space-time based on essentially knowing how the system radiates. That's the only piece of information that goes into it. Okay, so now what about the firewall paradox? I told you about the good and the bad Wick contractions. The operation that I was just giving you, this reconstruction of the interior of the black hole, only works, and I wasn't precisely careful enough perhaps of telling you that this is the case, only works if this code subspace is much smaller than the maximal Hilbert space, size of the Hilbert space. It turns out that this recovery operation actually has an error. And the error is proportional to the size of this Hilbert space, this code Hilbert space, divided by the full Hilbert space. So if the black hole gets very old, and if this density matrix starts occupying the full diagonal of your Hilbert space, then the whole procedure actually breaks down. And it turns out the reason for it is because the bad Wick contraction starts dominating, and you get an error in your recovery operation, and the internal quantum field theory starts breaking down. Now, at this point, I could stop and just say, oh, well, it means that the Santa Barbara people are right, and there's a firewall for old black holes. So in this regime here, this reconstruction doesn't work. But basically, the reason for why it doesn't work is because we're trying to do too much. The reason why it doesn't work is what we're trying to do is we're trying to take a state of a black hole that's maximally uncertain. It occupies all its quantum states. And I just try to describe, assign a classical reality to it just in one swoop. And that won't work. How does a classical reality emerge? It's because, okay, why is this a classical space-time for me? Because I've looked at it and I've become entangled with you guys, even, right? So we're all part of the same classical world because we're sharing information. So someone who falls into a black hole knows more about the black hole than absolutely nothing. So one way of saying this is as follows, is that if this density matrix of the black hole becomes very mixed once you start approaching this regime, the old regime, what you would have to do is you would have to give yourself a little bit more information. You have to say, okay, well, this black hole, this density matrix, I can chunk it up into different linear superpositions of classical realities. And each of those classical realities, say 1, 2, and 3 in this case, I can associate what I call then a code space to it, where I just say, well, okay, if I want to describe what happens in this part of the state, what does it describe? I can do my reconstruction nicely if I know it sits here. If I know it sits there, I can do it also. If I know it sits there, I can do it also. The thing I would not be able to do, this is where the error comes in, if I want to do this all for all the states at once. Now, people were aware of this. So this formula here, I should say, is the following. So if I want to construct an operator that lives in the interior of the black hole, what I would have to do is I have to write it as a sum of a little piece of extra information that I'm giving myself, namely, in which part of the Hilbert space does the black hole sit. And then I can construct the interior of the black hole, but I would have to project onto that part of the Hilbert space. And the discussion that's been going on recently in this whole field is, okay, well, how do you do that projection? And there are people that are complaining about that projection. They say, okay, well, if I look at a state, I should not be able to ask first what the state is. I just experience the state and not first measure it and then experience it, which is what they call nonlinearity. So it's not possible to first project on some state and then measure it. What you would have to do is you would have to project on something else that's entangled with that part of the Hilbert space. So there has to be another Hilbert space that's not the Hilbert space of the black hole that's entangled with the black hole. And then you project on it, and then you can measure. The other objection that people would say, well, hey, what I'm telling you here is that I have to introduce some projection onto these spaces, and that projection does not rely on the interior of the black hole. But wait, I was trying to construct an operator that lives inside of the black hole. Why would it be allowed to project on something else that's not inside of the black hole and use that to do that projection? So what about locality? Let me address those two questions in combination with, I'll use 3 more minutes and then I'll be done. In combination with an argument that's sort of the most, I would say, academic version of the Santa Barbara argument. So it has an academic version of the Santa Barbara argument, which goes back again to this picture, where basically people say, well, hey, what if someone already had measured this thing here, or had some clever quantum box that was measuring this thing here? Because basically what I've shown you is that just by the fact that this thing is radiating, that I can actually build entanglement between the interior and the exterior of the black hole. I've been able to show you that I can do it. But wait, the Santa Barbara will tell me, you're violating monogamy of entanglement, because B was already entangled with R. B comes out here, it can no longer be entangled with A. So what are you saying? Cannot be true. You cannot violate rules of quantum mechanics. However, if you are an observer and you fall into a black hole, I can look inside of the black hole, eventually. Right? I'm falling into the black hole, and there will come a point where I'll just look inside of the black hole. And how does that happen? So if I'm outside of the black hole, then there is a stretched horizon that sits at the horizon of the black hole, and that's my horizon. I cannot look farther than that. But at some point, I decide to fall into the black hole, and I look. And I will not see a firewall approaching me. Believe me, I will not see it. I will see empty space. I will keep seeing empty space. And at some point, I look behind the horizon. And when you look behind the horizon, you see photons or you see don't see photons, but you do a measurement. So if you are Alice and you want to fall into a black hole, eventually you'll do some measurement. And you may actually have done a measurement on the radiation and maybe the earlier radiation. And as for, I'm sure all of you know about quantum teleportation, that's actually what's going to happen here, is that the measurement that Alice does here when she goes into the black hole will have done some kind of combined measurement on the radiation on this bit R, where she will have project on some kind of entangled state between R and something else. And when you do that, when you build entanglement between R and E, then actually, according to the quantum teleportation protocol, this quantum bit will partially actually go this way. And it can reappear somewhere else if you have classical information. And that classical information is obtained by looking at the outcome of this measurement. Classical information can go into the black hole, and it will be there in the form of what we call code bits. And those code bits will tell me in which code space I am. And then once I know in which code space I am, then I can use that classical bit to take the bit that was entangled with this guy and rotate it into the entangled bit with B. This is how the quantum teleportation protocol works. You have an EPR pair, someone projects it onto one of the Bell states. Depending on the size of the measure, the outcome of the measurement, sends the information to the other side. Someone else has an other EPR, the partner of one of the EPR particles, and you can recreate this particle up there. So in the current literature, this is called the R equals A or A equals RB scenario. But it basically tells you that this bit here eventually got quantum teleported over there. So this is, I think, whoever doesn't believe in the firewall argument these days, this is essentially the way they did that. Let me stop here. Let me just mention make one last comment. Most of you will not be able to read what's on this slide. But I should say that the firewall argument made a particular assumption about what it requires to reconstruct something on the interior of a black hole. And they made use of a version of complementarity, or they were arguing against a version of complementarity that Susskind put forward. But in a paper with Kim and my brother 17 years ago, we formulated a version of space-time complementarity, which I think already answers the firewall paradox, if you take that version. You have to slightly reformulate it, but not much. So we call that space-time complementarity, and the picture was the following, is that if you imagine just evolving forward in time, and if you take a black hole space-time, you should just be able to draw smooth slices where you never get close to the singularity. This was always the argument for why black holes' horizons are smooth, because you can draw slicing where you never get close to the singularity. But there's still a problem, because there are enormous boosts involved if you draw those slices. And also, if you're too ambitious in trying to reconstruct quantum field theory on those slices, you'll get into trouble. And what we said is the following, is that if you give yourself a slice, a space-time slice, and you want to assign a semi-classical reality to it, you give yourself a cutoff. You're never going to do continuum quantum field theory, because continuum quantum field theory will have stress-energy fluctuations. And if gravity is turned on, those stress-energy fluctuations will make things too uncertain, will make space-time too uncertain. But you're going to give yourself a variable cutoff that depends on the location of where you are on a Cauchy surface. And it provides a permissible semi-classical description of the second quantized Hilbert space and of space-time only if the quantum fluctuations of the local background geometry induced by the corresponding stress-energy fluctuations do not exceed the cutoff itself. Now, here we were aware of the fact that if you want to have too fine-grained of a description down here, for sure things will start to fluctuate over here. But we were aware of the fact that if you know too much about space-time over there, then eventually you start running into trouble even in describing the physics down here. That's what the firewall argument is basically about, is that if there's too much information there, then this will become maximally entangled with that, and I can no longer reconstruct space-time locally. So there's something funny going on with cutoff scales where you, and this is where holography comes in and where complementarity comes in, which has to do with a certain set of rules that allows you to transfer information from all the way down there to here. And I think we still haven't fully learned that lesson at the end, but I think that's one of the reasons for why the firewall argument is actually interesting, because this will tell us something about how quantum field theory breaks down. Thank you. Yes?
So in the early stage, you have the recovery operator as the effect of giving you the state I, which is the initial state of black hole.
That's right.
And the ancilla state, which then becomes the
right
effect. So what the recovery operator is doing here is saying that black hole kind of contains still all the initial information about how it's formed. But it seems to me then what happens at late times is that you don't have that. You wouldn't expect that, right? That's at roughly the phase time information starts to come out.
That's right. So indeed, you get the picture that precisely the place where the recovery operation. So basically, the recovery operation is the thing that succeeds with keeping the information inside of the black hole, but it will start to fail because the information will start leaking out, and eventually it will start leaking out with probability one, which basically means that the recovery operation will break down with probability one. Now, actually, the ancilla part is never really existent, because we actually, using the ancilla part just as an algebraic trick, it will drop out of the calculation in the end. So the ancilla Hilbert space never exists for us.
So sorry, I thought this was supposed to represent the kind of the internal degrees of freedom of the black hole.
So one of the problems, and this is that you pointed out with John, because if I wouldn't have done this projection down here, if I would have done this projection, if this would have been my final state projection, a la Horowitz, Maldacena, then there would have been a problem, as you pointed out. Namely, if this ancilla was really a real part of my Hilbert space, then it should have had a Hamiltonian. And then there would have been unitaries that would be acting here, which would screw up this whole thing. So in the end, what we do is we actually define this operator. It's really a linear operator defined by the matrix element. So this Hilbert space for us is really literally an auxiliary Hilbert space. It doesn't exist. So in that respect, we're not really doing the recovery operation in the way people do it in the quantum computer business. Because there what indeed happens is that the entanglement between I and B gets swapped into entanglement between A and B. And that entanglement swap is not taking place here. So we're doing something more subtle than that. I should also say that this actually answers partially goes towards a reconstruction of the interior of a black hole in ADS-CFT. What people do in interiors of black hole ADS-CFT, they kind of take the state that you get and also write it essentially as an Unruh state. So they also write down this state, but just by means of analytic continuation. Whereas here we're doing something more subtle. We're using this recovery operation, which is only an imperfect way of reconstructing the interior. Actually, the reason why we know that we're doing something less trivial than just analytic continuation is that we can actually show where this formula breaks down. There are actually plus dot, dot, dot that I didn't write down here. But the plus dot, dot, dot will indeed start appearing when the recovery operation fails. But my interpretation of this is the following, is that the recovery operation will fail if I start applying it to a situation that's actually a linear superposition of two classical space-times. but I'm treating them as if it's one classical space-time. So in my opinion, the information will start leaking out of the black hole because at the moment that its state starts becoming a superposition of classical space-time, and the superposition of classical space-time can have information leaking out, whereas each of the classical space-times themselves is able to keep the information in. And that's represented by this next picture, that each of these boxes is capable of keeping the information in. This box can keep the information in. That box can keep the information in. But the whole thing as a whole, if I would do the recovery operation on the whole thing, I would not be able to keep the information in. So this is a classical space-time where the information is can be recovered. Information can be recovered. Information can be recovered. But the recovery operation, I cannot write down a single recovery operation for the whole thing. And it's because of a superposition that we're kind of overusing the...
At all distinguishable from treating it as a fuzz ball with all the sets of the complex atoms that emits, that goes through conditions and emits photons that are highly entangled with the surface?
So indeed, there's the fuzzball and the fireball kind of are also antagonists, I guess, in this respect. Or at least maybe they're not antagonists. They like each other because one justifies the other. Part of the point of view of the fuzzball people is, although if you talk to, it's a bit confusing what they actually say. They would tell you also that you bump your head if you want to go through a horizon because there's actually a fuzzball sitting there. But at the same time, they tell you that the spectrum of fuzzballs is extremely dense. And if you talk to Samir Mathur, he will actually tell you that indeed, if for appropriate high energy modes, or at least short, high frequency things, they will actually just go into the fuzzball as if there's empty space there. So you will get easily absorbed by the fuzzball. So to me, it's not entirely clear if the fuzzball people are saying, well, it's really a fuzzball there, or if I fall into a black hole, I either bump my head or I don't. I think it's a relatively clear cut. And if they would say, well, actually, you don't, the fuzzballs are just a way of representing the atom, I'm all with them. But then I don't know why you would describe it in terms of classical solutions. It's just quantum states. That's the whole point of the stressed horizon. It's the fact that it's not a classical region of space-time. You have to describe it quantum mechanically. You have to do superposition quantum mechanics. And superpositions of fuzzballs are no longer fuzzballs. They're just superposition of quantum states.
I'm trying to take in what your big picture is. I'm not sure. I'm sure that I'm not succeeding. But let me try. So these late-time code states have to be, if I understand, quite a small fraction of them.
Right, but what is a small fraction?
What puts you in that small fraction is a different classical, external classical space-time. So is it as if you're saying that the reason we get a pure state in the end is that we collapse, we project down onto one classical space.
Yeah, so the question...
That has the effect of removing
right,
the
right,
between the
right,
inside and outside. Is that the
yeah, so it's clear. It's clear that the process of falling into a black hole involves projecting on classical space-times. If you want to define an observable that's inside of a classical black hole, you have to invoke the environment of the black hole. Those things are all clear. The thing that I'm not quite as clear about is what's the level of non-locality that one would need. How local is this process of projecting on the appropriate classical state? Is it something that you just do yourself by doing the measurement on the black hole, or is there some magic collapse of the wave? At least, how should I say? Is there some magic transfer of entanglement? How should I say? Are there certain quantum mechanical excitations that Bob, who's outside of the black hole, would disagree with Alice? Where Bob would say, well, this thing is here, and Alice would say, no, the thing is here. And you would have to be a bit more clear about what that dictionary is. And we haven't quite reached that point yet. But in my opinion, the reason why I'm sort of excited about this is that if there are classical bits involved here, which tell you which code space you are, so if I give myself a bunch of classical bits, I can reconstruct the interior of the black hole. So it's sort of a step towards holography for black holes that we're doing here. It's sort of the ADS-CFT type correspondence, but just only making use of thermodynamics without knowing anything about the details of the dynamics. But the thermodynamics already allows you to reconstruct the local Unruh state in this. The question you're asking is the crucial one. What allows you to do these projections? Yes. Yes.
One of the assumptions that you used is that the dimension of the Hilbert space describing the black hole is given by the exponential of the Beckenstein
model. That's right.
So this is one of the complementary assumptions. But I believe that original firewall paper didn't use it. It's like the one assumption of complementarity that they don't use.
Yeah, no, right. So our point of view was precisely we wanted to hammer on number three, namely the So they had four assumptions. Which was it? The S matrix.
Yes.
Now the S matrix is kind of right. That takes this very long time point of view where you only measure things as asymptotic at infinity. Then they had quantum field theory outside of the stretched horizon. That's clearly the one that's too strong. It's clear that there must be some restriction on quantum field theory outside of the stretched horizon. And we want to learn more about that. That, I think, is the consensus of people both that are advocating a firewall picture. At least if you would ask Joe Pachinski, he would probably tell you, what the firewall argument shows is that if you strictly do low-energy quantum field theory outside of the black hole, you will get yourself into trouble if you force yourself to reconstruct the interior of the black hole with everything else. So you have to have some violation of locality. So that's number two. Number three is indeed the membrane, where you assume that there's a finite number of states in the membrane, which for us is crucial. And number four was the no drama thing, which again should be a constant. So we've not assumed four. We've kind of shown that if you know where you are, then there's no drama. We can reconstruct the no drama because we're getting this state, and this state says no drama.
But I guess my question, though, is that you've shown that you only have an issue.
You don't. You can fall into a black hole.
You only have an issue when this sort of code Hilbert space bumps up against the black hole Hilbert space, meaning the black hole is maximum.
That's right. That's right.
Now, so my question is: suppose you drop this assumption. Suppose that the Hilbert space actually has many more states than the Beckenstein entropy. It seems that what you're saying is that in your picture, there's no paradox, whereas AMPS never used that assumption. So to them, there is a paradox. So do you think there is?
No, the thing is that the fact that they never used an assumption, the real way of stating the Amps paradox is precisely that the state eventually becomes maximally mixed. That's precisely what they're assuming. And by the way, the fact that n code over n is small, if the entropy of the actual black hole is 0.9999999 times the Beckenstein-Hawking entropy, then this over this is still tiny. Because this is an enormous entropy, and I put it in the exponent. So even if I'm all the way squished against here, if there's a tiny little bit of extra space here between the maximal entropy and the actual entropy of the black hole, then this is still tiny. But the real paradox, I would say, is to explain precisely what happens in this region. How is it possible that a black hole can reduce its entropy and keep radiating? That's really the paradox. And there's no way of going around that by and making the Hilbert space bigger. Eventually, you have to tell yourself, OK, how can the black hole decrease its energy and decrease its entropy while keeping radiating? And there's no classical way in which it can do it. That's a